2% of people think, 3% of people think they think, and 95% of people would rather die than think. Most people don't actually think. We don't think new thoughts. We have about 70 or 80,000 thoughts a day. 95% of them are the exact same thoughts we had the previous day and the day before and the day before. So it's very unpredictable. You can't create it yourself. So the best way to try and change those paradigms and to change how you're thinking and by default then how you operate is through constant spaced repetition. And that's what we try to do with our clients. We try to educate them in why it is better in most cases to change their habits when it comes to pricing and how we can potentially help them make more revenue, make more profit, and have a better business. And they used to think I was a little bit crazy in sixth, but I was a firm believer there's enough business there for everybody. We get our percentage of our business by operating and concentrating on our business, by doing the best that we can for our customers, regardless of what everybody else is doing. I mean, do you need to be aware of what's going on in your industry? Of course you do, yeah? But if you spend all this time looking over your shoulder, you know, or looking around you at what everybody else is doing, your own house is going to fall.
You are listening to Revenue Machine, the podcast dedicated to revenue management in Carendel. We have created it to enhance your genuine zone. I'm Emmanuel Scuto, the founder and CEO of WeYield, and a revenue machinist. My ambition is to give knowledge and share experience in order to get inspiration. To do what? To reach a new level of performance, but also to have a better clarity and more freedom in the way you do your job every day. Today we are in Berlin. We are just ready to attend the ITB conference. We are in March 24, and today I have the pleasure to greet Adrian Tracy. You know, the revenue management is not only a set of techniques or tools. For me, revenue management is a way of conducting the business. And despite the big part taken by computer over the last decade, still, for example, airline companies and hotel chains have humans behind the driving wheel. They are here to set, manage, and control the strategy. This is what we call revenue management. And today I've invited Adrian Tracy to talk about the mindset. After 15 years working in the car rental industry, in operations, in sales, Adrian joined WeYield as a customer success manager. But interesting enough, he has also another activity as consultant and coach in mindset. What is it about? We'll know. So he created a company called Quantum Leap Consulting. And his favorite statement is, the only obstacle between you and the success you crave is yourself. So we are going to talk today about what prevents the companies to set a successful revenue management. And it is not only a question of tools or techno. I can guarantee you. So we are going to discuss about the balance between the systems and the mind. How does our mind works facing an uncertain environment? We are usually in car rental, the volatility is extreme. How does our past experience influence our capacity to accept the change and also the discomfort that comes with it? What are the actions we put in place to set a new mindset? So, welcome, Adrian, on the Revenue Machine podcast.
Welcome, or thank you. Welcome. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's like you're already at home. So, yeah. So that's cool. Do you want to, may I ask you the first question, which is, do you want to introduce yourself briefly to the audience?
Sure. So I'm Adrian Tracy, as Emmanuel said. I currently work with WeYield as a customer success manager. Prior to joining and working with WeYield, I spent 9 years working with Sixt Rent-A-Car in Ireland in a number of different roles. I started off managing our airport location, then sort of transitioned over into sales and what we call channel management. And that was a funny one for all of the rental agents who had worked for me beforehand, because they kept asking me, what does a channel manager do? So I used to always say, well, when we have a company get together, I have the remote control. I get to choose what's on the television, yeah, as a channel manager. So prior to working with Sixt, I spent 7 years with Enterprise Rent-A-Car, also in Ireland, in various different roles, managing small branches and some larger branches. And even though that seems like a lifetime ago, I prior working in car rental, I worked in the hotel industry. I studied hotel management straight out of secondary school and in college. Worked with Marriott Hotels over in the US, worked with Sheraton Hotels in Germany, and some smaller hotel chains in Ireland. And as anybody who's worked in hotels knows, you do everything from unclogging toilets to carrying bags to serving people in the restaurant. So, my entire life so far has been in the service industry.
And why did you move from the hotel industry then to the car rental? Because a significant part of your life was in car rental.
Yeah.
Why this switch? Was it an opportunity? Was it you wanted to change the industry, to test something new? Or?
I wanted to try something different. So we'll get onto it, I suppose, a little bit later. But there was something that I learned in college, which was Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And the top level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs is becoming all that you can become. Now, when I worked in the hotels, I worked in the States, and when I came back into Dublin, I worked on the opening of 3 hotels in a row. So anybody who's worked on the opening of a hotel knows that you have no life outside of that for that period of time until the hotel opens. So after the third one, and after I had been there for about 6 to 8 months after opening, I remember distinctly looking at my general manager one day, who's probably the same age as I am now, and thought to myself, do I want to be doing what he's doing now when I'm his age? And the answer was no.
Okay.
I did not want to be working 17 hours a day in order to not just practice, I was actually living in the hotel in the period coming up to the opening, because there was just so much to do. A friend of mine was working in Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and they had an employee referral scheme. And he said, I'll tell you what, if you're getting fed up, come join me in Enterprise and I'll split the employee referral bonus with you, which was about 3,000 euros at the time. So I would have got 1,500. So I said, sure, why not? Yeah, we'll try something different. So I went from working a 17 hours a day to 10. And I thought, this is brilliant. Yeah. I got a lunch break. You know, the manager of the office told me to get out of the office for an hour and come back. And I was like, what is this? Yeah, I'd never had a lunch break like that before. And so for me, getting into what was a really, really busy atmosphere was less busy than what I was used to. And so when I joined Enterprise, everybody who joins starts and goes through the management trainee program. So I started off as a management trainee in a local office. It was about an 80 to 100 car branch, sometimes over 120 cars or so. And within 12 to 18 months, I was managing my own branch as a branch manager. So,
and do you think like in the way the hotel industry worked at that time, was it something intentional? It's still the same after 20 years, you think? Or no, they have to change. Hopefully after COVID, they have changed a lot. I don't know. Or they are still in the same way of...
I'm very far removed from it now, I must say. But the impression that I got at that time was that it's like a rite of passage. Do you understand that saying? Yeah. So my managers and the GM would have gone through working these long hours in order to progress, in order to go up the chain, and so that it was expected that you would do the same thing. And this would have been in the mid to late noughties, let's say, in Ireland, where there were so many tax breaks for developers to build a hotel in everything that they built, so there were hotels everywhere. And the problem was these hotels, in my opinion, they weren't being run by hoteliers. They were being run as an investment. So the investment had to get a return. As it does in a hotel, obviously, but, you know, a hotelier approaches it slightly differently. And so it was as if the accountants were running the hotels. It was cut. All of your hourly staff. I mean, it makes logical sense when you think about it, but cut all your hourly staff and have your salaried staff work extra hours because we're not paying them anything extra, and they'll cover the shifts and they'll make it work. I don't know if it's still like that now, but I hope it's not.
As a matter of fact, what we have seen after COVID, because we are recording in 24, I was reading in the newspaper this morning that still like a big hotel chain like Accor, for example, they are still struggling to get staff because those guys have been fired during COVID, but they don't want to come back to work. Yeah. And I know that they have changed management processes. They've also changed bonus scheme and the wages. Mm-hmm. I think they've been too far on that. And even at restaurant level, it's difficult now to find waiters and to find guys working in the kitchen because those guys, they don't want to work. They, you know, they never have lunch. They never have dinner with their family. It's really special job. Huh?
It is. I mean, the service industry as a whole is like that. You know, it's not as high as a calling from God, etc., to be a priest or anything like that, but it is a calling. It's people who will do it because that's how they are. That's how they like to be. They like to serve people and look after people more so than anything else. So some of my friends and colleagues in the hotel industry might say that I'm wrong, but I do think there's still that issue in Ireland in trying to replace those people. I mean, the tourism industry in Ireland is the second largest employer after agriculture. Pre-COVID, there was about 250,000 jobs in the hospitality sector. Obviously, COVID devastated it completely. But I still think there is a massive shortage. I mean, there are restaurants that close on days where they ordinarily would have been open because they don't have a 7-day operation. They don't have enough staff to cover the 7 days. There's other factors that are affecting it and making it less profitable to run that sort of a business, a restaurant or a hotel. And I don't disagree with them. There's the minimum wage and there's the living wage within Ireland, which help people to make a career out of it. But I think, and seeing as we're in Germany, it's fortuitous. The service industry in a lot of countries isn't seen as a career, whereas it is here in Germany. I studied and I worked here in Munich back in the early noughties, 2000, 2001. And at that time, a lot of the people who were working in the hotels were apprentices. So they go to school, they learn how to be a chef or they learn how to be a waiter, you know, and that is a career. And sometimes those sort of positions can be handed down from father to son, etc., you know, and they're coveted positions and they're well-paid positions. Plus tips are not bad either. Mm-hmm. But it's seen as a career. And I really like that. Whereas most of the time, even in Ireland, the managerial positions are a career. But it's not really seen as a career that people want to get into to be a waiter or a waitress or something along those lines. And that's a shame because it can be a very rewarding career, you know.
And when you moved to the car rental, did you notice the same, like the car rental staff? Do they have the same type of approach or feeling about their career? Is it also a kind of, not a career, I would say? Or are you, even if we stay in the service industry, you have seen something different in the approach, in the feeling of each staff?
So the car rental industry, I always felt, it is a male-dominated industry. And for whatever reason, women generally maybe don't seem to be attracted to cars, and it has that attraction to young guys in their 20s to, you know, be driving cars around the place and that sort of thing, and they like that. I saw that I changed from checking people, because I worked in the front office, mostly in the hotels, that I went from checking people into rooms to checking people into cars. So for me, there was a great correlation between the two. And when I was coaching my team at the desk up in Dublin Airport, it was, my ethos was, you are an ambassador for the country. You are the first person that those guests who come off the planes meet outside of passport control, you know, and God knows how that went. But you're the first person that they're going to meet in the country. And we have a great responsibility to try and give Ireland a good name. And that was our ethos. It was trying to make the experience as pleasant as possible. Because you've no idea what has happened to that person before they get to your counter. Could have had a lost bag, maybe a baby was crying on their flight, maybe somebody got sick on the flight, or it was turbulence, they're scared, etc. But you can be the first person to welcome them to a new country and really set them up for success on their trip if you do it right. Or conversely, if you do it wrong, they would come away with the sort of rip off Ireland connotation, as a lot of people do.
And whenever, I would add that, whenever there is a shuttle, even the bus driver is so important, because if the guy is rude or if the guy is not polite or whatever, yeah, that will really be the last person they will see or the first one they will meet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was so proud of our bus drivers, and a few of them were absolutely fabulous. They would chat the whole way down, and it was I timed it. It was a six to seven minute journey from the terminal to being dropped off at the depot. And, you know, some of the drivers would be really chatty, would be chatting to the people. They'd be like, okay, see there, there's the closest petrol station. So when you're coming back, there's where you're going to be able to fill up this roundabout here. If you go straight through here, you're out onto the motorway, etc. And they'd be giving them tips of places to visit, etc. And the amount of great comments that we got about our bus drivers was amazing. Yeah, so you're right. They have a huge part. And then obviously on the way back also. So you only have one chance to make a good first impression and only one chance to make a good final impression.
And when you had you moved from really hotel operations to car rental operations and then to more kind of back office, mm-hmm, with a sales and a channel manager, as you said, how was this progression? How did you feel moving back from operations where there is this pressure, this also people like to have this interactivity with customer, when usually when you're on back office side, you may have a more distance with the clientele. How did you feel it?
That's a very interesting question, because it is something that's incredibly difficult, and I found it difficult. When you think about, say, 10 years in the hotel industry on the front line, another 10 years or so on the front line in car rental, always run, go, and then moving into corporate sales, which is a much longer sort of sales cycle. It could be, I talk to somebody today and I close a sale 6 months from now. I never ever had to worry about what I was doing next when I was in operations, because there was always a fire to put out. There was always a question to be asked. I was talking to somebody the other day and I said that, and there's no guidebook to go when you move from operations to a back office or to a head office role. It can be quite daunting, a little bit different. But over time, I got used to it and enjoyed it.
And is it the moment where you start analyzing a little bit more the behavior of maybe the colleagues and the people, and eventually maybe the staff as well, the clients, but mostly internally? When did you start having this kind of mindset approach, or did you realize a particular moment or something happened in your life that said, oh, what is going on in this company? Or
So the path, let's say, to getting onto personal development and into mindset was quite a long one. As I say, back when my college days, it was something that I had a great interest in, and out throughout my career, I always strove to get better and to improve and to change my position, and probably very impatiently so, to always want to move up to the next ladder quicker rather than waiting. You know, I was always quite impatient to move up, and it was something. And when the move up, or when I reached that sort of glass ceiling, is what I called it, where there wasn't, within the organization where I was, there wasn't really anywhere to progress further. I had a moment of talking to myself and going, okay, are you happy to settle? Are you happy that you have a decent job? It's interesting. You get to do some cool things. You get to meet some really nice people. Is that enough that you can just settle? And probably for about 6 months, I talked to myself about, yeah, just settle. You know, you're okay where you are. You know, you're comfortable. You're fine.
How old were you at that time?
Mid-30s.
Okay.
Yeah. And after 6 months, I remember distinctly having a conversation with myself, telling myself, as we say in Ireland, to cop on. Yeah, wake up. You know, that's not you. You're not happy with where you are. And there is more that you're capable of doing, that you want to do. So start it. Do it. And that's really what sort of kicked me into getting on board with mindset in a much bigger way. I had been aware of Bob Proctor for a few years. He was one of the granddaddies of sort of personal development, so I'd heard him speak on various things. Tony Robbins, probably everybody knows Tony with his mad energy, but Bob was much more, not refined is not the right word, but he was much more relaxed. He had energy. God, he had energy. He kept going until he was 86, 87, and then he passed away about 2 years ago. But right up until he died, he was still recording. I was on calls with him and other people right up until he passed away. And phenomenal man. But he had his own way about doing it. It was slightly different. He was more of a classical American orator, if you want. He was. He learned from a guy called Billy Gove. He learned from Earl Nightingale. Earl Nightingale was a TV host. A radio show host. He had a much more, it just wasn't this frenzied energy. You would never see him bouncing around on the stage.
Like Tony Yorovitz.
And I love Tony, but different people have different ways of communicating.
Absolutely.
And Bob's way of communicating just really spoke to me. And that's when I went through a program called Thinking Into Results with a local person in Ireland as my mentor. And I loved it. And that's what really sort of caused me to wake up and go, there's more that you can do.
And then with this more that can be done, that you can do, what did you trigger then? That was the time when you changed the company, or that was the time when you just ask for more and continue to progress or maybe you switch to within the company from the front office to the back office of the sales?
It was around about that time because I had a good hard look at myself and I said, do you see yourself continuing to run an operation? Because at that stage and be modest about it, I could run an operation no problem with my eyes closed. You know, I had done it for years. There was nothing challenging to it. And for me, and what I've learned since, is goals and having a goal that you're working towards. As humans, we're goal-orientated organisms. We have to be striving for something. And there's a basic law, really, in life, is that if you're not growing, you're dying. So if you don't have something that you're aiming towards, you're just existing, and there's no fun in that. And that's really where I was. I was at that stage where I was just existing, you know. Did I still work hard? Of course I did. Did I put all my effort into it? Of course I did. But at the end of the day, I went home and I wasn't overjoyed, I wasn't excited or anything like that. And it became monotonous. So it was around about that time that I decided I would try something different. Then COVID happened. That put the brakes on some of the changes that I was thinking about. And at that stage, it was just survive through COVID. Yeah, it could be quite difficult.
And when did you create Quantum Leap? That was before COVID? That was during COVID?
It was 2020. So around about in the middle of COVID.
Absolutely, yeah.
For me, the lockdowns in Ireland were like, for me, winning the lottery. Because, okay, I was working from home, but I got to spend so much more time with my kids. I got more time. I didn't have lose an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening commuting to and from. And it just gave me the time to think. And I'm sure I've told you before, there's one of my favorite sayings is 2% of people think, 3% of people think they think, and 95% of people would rather die than think. Most people don't actually think. We don't think new thoughts. We have about 70 or 80,000 thoughts a day. 95% of them are the exact same thoughts we had the previous day and the day before and the day before.
And in addition, I would add that most of them are negative.
Yes, yeah.
So it's funny because whenever we ask somebody, okay, how was your day today? Or how was your week before? They mostly talk about difficulties.
Yeah.
Or pains or struggles. And it's extremely difficult to extract something. They say, okay, tell me what are you happy about?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly say, okay, let me think.
There's another saying, I love my sayings. As a saying in Ireland, misery loves company. And, you know, it's very easy to talk about the problems that we have because somebody will always chime in and go, oh, that's nothing. My problem is way worse than that. And then it's almost like a competition as to who has it worst. And as I've said before, we become what we think about. And if we're thinking about negative things all day long, that's what we're going to end up attracting to ourselves. It's always this negative. And it's a downward spiral. It's not that it's difficult to stop. It can be stopped. But it just takes a change in perspective in order to do it. Yeah. It's just one of those things. It takes a conscious effort to do it, and you need to realize where you are, realize what you want, make a decision that you want to change something, and then you do it. Nothing happens at all until you make a decision. I remember Bob used to always talk about the excuses that people would come up with for not changing their job, for not starting their business. Oh, I don't have this. Oh, I don't have that. And he would go, well, what are you giving out about? You don't need it. And we're like, yeah, but if I want to do it, I need to have... Yeah, but you haven't decided to do it yet. Well, as soon as you decide to do it, you find a way. And it's very true. Once you decide that you're going to do something, you will find a way to make it work. Once you're connected to it on what I call an emotional level, once you're deeply connected to your goal, nothing will stop you from achieving it.
Anyway, and that's funny because then you move from, let's say, a traditional way of running car rental,
mm-hmm.
to a more consulting approach, a more support. Was it for you a chance to say, okay, let's experience what I was working or what I had in mind regarding this support, mentorship, and put it into practice, moving out from operations and let's see how it goes to support and help companies to implement revenue management. Yeah. What was the how did you think about this? Because then you left 15 years, I would say, 15 years of... 16 years of comfort, something that you knew at the top of your fingers, even not need to think, even though you switched from operation to sales. But So your decision was, okay, let's do something else?
Yeah. So at the beginning of COVID, or let's say halfway through COVID, I made the decision that I was going to do something different. And I created my company. And I called my company Planboy, which is P-L-A-M-B-O-I. And the reason, a funny story as to why I chose that, I'm all about family. So my my wife is from Estonia. My mother-in-law is from the Ukraine. And she was over helping us look after Emma, my youngest daughter, when she was born. She was with us for a while. Now, my mother-in-law doesn't speak a whole lot of English. She speaks Russian. And my kids don't speak a lot of Russian. So between Anna and Emma, my two daughters, they figured out a way to communicate to my mother-in-law that they wanted to go to the playground. They thought they were speaking Russian, and my mother-in-law thought she was speaking English. Planboy is the word that they used for playground. Yeah. So when I decided to create a company, I was like, I have to make it something that's unique, something that means something to me, something that means nothing to anybody else. And I was like, I know, I'm going to call my company Planboy. Obviously, I used the Quantum Leap Consulting because that does make actual sense. But yeah, Planboy is the company name. So when I decided to make that jump, I know now what was going on inside my mind, and I didn't know at that stage. And there is everything in the world vibrates. And this is where it gets a little bit funny for some people, and I lose some people when I start talking about this. But everything in the world vibrates. We vibrate. The table in front of us vibrates. If you look at it under a microscope, an electron microscope, and you look it down at the atoms and electrons, etc., they're held together by an energy, and everything is vibrating. And our thoughts have a vibration. When we're thinking thoughts that we're not thinking thoughts, but we're saying having the same thoughts as what we had yesterday, we're at a certain vibration. When you begin to think thoughts that are outside of what you do every day, those thoughts are at a different vibration. And because those thoughts are at different vibrations, they're not at ease with each other, they're at dis-ease. Yeah? And that causes us to be very uncomfortable because we don't know what's going on within us. Yeah? And we hit something that we call the terror barrier. And the terror barrier is what forces us. We go to step out. We go to entertain these new thoughts that are at this vibration. We go to step out. Something happens and we jump. It's like we hit a wall and then we jump back into our comfort zone. We jump back into what we're used to doing. It's very hard to do this without my diagram with the stick man. I'm so used to drawing this out for people to explain it. But essentially, that's what happens, is we think our thoughts, which are our normal thoughts, we generally call them X-type thoughts, and when we go to step out and do something different, we have Y thoughts. We have thoughts that are unusual. So because of those different vibrations, we have an XY vibration, and that causes us to be completely, you know, jittery or at unease. And when we hit an obstacle, as you always do hit an obstacle whenever you go to try anything, we let that obstacle overcome us and we jump back into our safe zone, into our comfort zone. So I now understand what's happening. So when I now step out to do something that's outside of what I'm used to doing, I understand why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. And I really believe that the key to changing anything is education and understanding. If you don't understand what's going on, you're going to get scared and you're going to go back into where you were beforehand. So the key to changing anything is education and understanding.
And what we are doing at We Yield, when we implement revenue management, as I said as the introduction, it's really to more than tools and mathematics and computers that are important too, but it's also a way to conduct the business. And that's interesting what you just said, because we have some clients that instantly are okay with this concept, even though for them it's still a bit vague. They say, maybe it vibrates, as you say, for them. And they said, okay, I need to change the way I've been doing over 5 years, 10 years, more, sometime more, because the only thing I'm sure about, if I continue to apply the same bloody old method, I will get the same bloody old result. Yeah. That's guaranteed. And some of them say, sometimes they don't say, but it's like something difficult for them to catch or to understand. They say, okay, let's try. Let's see how this approach in revenue management can help. And do you see this now in your job, when you have to accompany, to support this transformation, this change?
Yes.
How this mindset approach, how do you use this mindset approach with your with the clients you are dealing with? And because they are coming from different parts of the world. And that's
there's a lot of differences, but an awful lot of similarities between our clients all over the world. One of the things that I have noticed, and I thought, well, first of all, I'm not a revenue manager. I know a certain amount about revenue management, but my background and isn't really. It's more to do with operations, etc. I've learned a hell of a lot from you and a hell of a lot from the other guys in the office, and from Sixth in Ireland, yeah. So the thing is, the clients who have really embraced our way of thinking, and I think about one client in particular, don't come from a background of car rental. So they don't have 5, 10, 15, 20 years of, we've always done it this way. You know, and that is, and not just in car rental, but in any business, I think that's probably the most dangerous sentence that you can ever hear is, we've always done it that way. Yeah. When I was laughing when you were saying about doing the same thing over and over again, it's a quote of Einstein, the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So some clients who come to it are very fresh into car rental, and that's brilliant because they embrace what we teach, apply it, and see the benefit of it. So that's the easy sell. And the more difficult one is people who have been doing it for years, because they have the mentality of, we've always done it this way, the whole market works this way, and we're just going to continue doing it this way. So.
And complain when the results are bad.
Yeah. So I suppose the tactic with that is a little bit more, it takes a little bit longer, I think. And it's more about going, well, we're not going to change everything. We're going to try something different. And if it doesn't work, okay, we'll roll back. I love when I did the interview with you a couple of weeks ago, and you talked about having the parrot on your shoulder going, well, I'm not changing everything, I'm just going to change a little bit, and we're going to try it. And I think that is a fantastic approach to this, especially with clients who have been doing this for a very long time, and, you know, who have got a certain amount of results, and are quite resistant to changing and trying something different. So rather than throwing everything out and starting afresh, it's really a step-by-step process. So, and when we think about how their mind works, and we understand that to get a new belief, to get a new, what I call a paradigm, into their subconscious mind, there's two ways to do it. One is a sudden emotional impact, and the second one is constant spaced repetition. So a sudden emotional impact is normally something that's negative. Bob used to always go on about, say, 9/11. 9/11 was a negative sudden emotional impact in the States that made the entire country believe on a subconscious level something about the perpetrators. So it's very unpredictable. You can't create it yourself. So the best way to try and change those paradigms and to change how you're thinking and by default then how you operate is through constant spaced repetition. So what I find myself doing in our client calls is that I keep repeating the same message over and over again. When we talk about yielding and we talk about slowly and gradually increasing the price along with your utilization over time prior to pickup day, I will repeat that every week over time. I will quite often draw it out, you know, on my tablet and share it on the screen. And I'll talk about it quite often. And it's by doing that, and that's how we change things, by listening to the same thing over and over again, by writing the same thing over and over again, and by speaking it, the same thing over and over again. Constant spaced repetition. And it can take anything from 21 to about 180 days to create a new belief or to create a new paradigm. So it's a process.
We were, a couple of weeks back, I followed a conference from Sama Karaki, who is a neuroscientist in France, and she was talking about how the brain works, and I'm sorry for my bad English, this synapses, we say mm-hmm. that?
Synapses, yeah.
Synapses. And in fact, we can take this as an image, like your reflex and the habits is a kind of freeway. Mm-hmm. So the electricity between those synapses goes for so long that the synapse is like extremely well done, built, and a bit hard, I mm-hmm. would say, if yeah. we say the physically speaking. And that whenever we want to try something new, the synapse does not exist. So we have to have a very small electric cable mm-hmm. to fix to another neurons. And if we don't build this habit, as you just said, and repeat over and over again, this first synapse will stop mm-hmm. because it's kind of new path in the middle of the jungle or whatever. So you have to create your pathway. And little by little, because we repeat, we find out that, oh, it's easier now. It's a kind of habit. I am able to understand something new, and it seems to be clear to me, and I'm not afraid anymore. Right. And it's simply in the brain, because then we build this new connection. It's not a freeway mm-hmm. yet, but eventually it's a kind of small road, and then in the future that will be a main road, and eventually a national road, and then maybe a whatever this kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's a really cool way to look at it as the road. The way it's a really interesting thing to sort of differentiate the brain from the mind. I could stand in front of 100 people, I ask them to close their eyes, and I go, right, tell me, what do you see when you think of the mind? And probably 99 out of 100 are going to say the brain.
Yeah. Instantly, I would answer the same. Yeah, clearly.
The mind is so much more than the brain. The brain is and the body that we're in is phenomenal. Yeah. But the brain is an electrical switching station. So just like what you said there with these electrical impulses, etc. What tells the brain where to send the electricity? That's what the mind is. We always say that the mind is in every cell of the body. And we are essentially our minds inhabiting the body. So the body is an instrument of the mind. The body does what we tell it to do. And so it's by the mind telling the body to create this new electrical impulse, or this new highway, this new passageway, or whatever the case may be, that we begin to change what the body actually does. But it's understanding that, this goes quite deep. Yeah, it's understanding that it's the mind that tells the body what to do, where the core of the understanding is really from. Most of the time, if I talk to people about coaching, if I talk to people about mentorship, etc., historically, most mentors or most coaches will focus on behaviors. And they will tell you that in order to change the result that you have, you need to start doing this differently. So change this, change this, and you get a different result. And you can see this all the time with people when they go on diets. They change the habit, and they get a different result. So they change what they're doing, they change the behavior. But the paradigm that is, and I'll explain a little bit more what a paradigm is, the paradigm which is within the person's subconscious mind is so strong that with as soon as they stop, let's say, working with this coach, they will revert back to their old behavior again. Because that's the programming that controls the body.
We have seen it with diets. Most of the time, yes. Whatever kilos you have lost, you get them back.
Yo-yo diets
exactly,
all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I suppose I'm no different. I'm a work in progress. I need to change my own paradigms, especially around food. But the paradigm is, the best way to describe it is like a computer software. And if you look at our think of our bodies as the hardware, the software is the paradigm that drives the hardware. So when you write a new piece of software, or if you try to adapt a piece of software that's already there, there's always going to be part of the old software that's still there. So if you want the computer or you want the machine to operate differently, you need to write a new, stronger program in order to change what the body is doing. And that's where this constant space repetition, and that's where this changing the paradigm comes in, because that's what is ultimately going to affect what your body is doing. Yeah. Now, this is so much easier with a pen and paper, right? Imagine a big circle.
It's just the voice that the podcast. That's an interesting exercise for you.
It is. Yeah. It is. I remember I
guys was... in front of him, and he's playing a lot with his hand. He has no pencil, no paper, nothing.
You know the old saying about how do you cause an Italian to shut up? It's like you tie his hands together. You know, I'm kind of the same. So if you imagine a big circle, or everybody has ever drawn a stick man figure, where you have a big circle for the head, and you have a line that comes down, and you have the arms and the legs coming out of it. If we imagine for a second, and this is an image that was created by a guy called Dr. Maxwell Maltz back in, I think it's about the 50s in the US, and he was a plastic surgeon. And he would operate on people to fix something that they didn't like about themselves, you know, whether it was a new nose or a disfiguring scar or something like that. And he came up with the idea that people have an image of themselves. There are two images that you have. You have the external image, which is the image that you project to other people, and you have the internal image, which is how you see yourself. And they're not always the same. So sometimes when he would perform a surgery on somebody and that they would begin to act differently than they did prior to the surgery, so that not only had they changed their external image, but their internal image had changed also. But quite often, nothing changed. And somebody who was quite shy, thinking that it was the scar that was on their face that they were ashamed of or whatever, once I fix that, I'm going to be so different, etc. But they never were, because they didn't fix the image they have of themselves on the inside. And so this is where this stick man figure comes in. It helps us to understand the difference between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. We would always say that there are two parts of the mind, and any psychologists who are listening will probably argue and say there's many more, and that's fine. But for me, I like to keep things simple. And there are two parts of the mind, the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. The conscious mind is the thinking or the logical mind, and that's where we think about things. So when somebody says something to you, it enters into your conscious mind, and you either accept it or reject it. So you go, yes, I believe that, and you pass it over to the subconscious mind, or you go, no, I don't believe that. And it disappears. You don't internalize it. It doesn't become part of your programming. The subconscious mind has got no ability to reject anything. It must accept everything that's impressed upon it. And if we imagine for a second that circle, that big circle, and there's a line across the middle of it, the conscious mind being the top half and the subconscious mind being the bottom half. If we were to remove the top half of it, so we remove the conscious mind, so we're only left with the subconscious mind, that is essentially what you are from the moment you're born up until about 7 or 8 years of age. So children only operate on the subconscious mind. They have to accept, and they do accept, and it's great fun having a bit of a laugh with them, and they accept anything that you tell them as fact. And that then forms part of their programming, because that's where the programming lives. So there's a long way around to say that having the fact that the subconscious mind cannot reject anything that's impressed upon it is where we get to how do we change a paradigm, how do we change that programming. And true constant spaced repetition, as in saying the same thing over and over again, writing the same thing over and over again, listening to the same thing over and over again, that's how we fool, let's say, our subconscious mind into believing that you have already achieved what it is that you want to achieve. And because the subconscious mind can't differentiate between fact and fiction, reality and imagination, it then will make you believe that you have achieved whatever it is that you want to achieve. And by doing that, that will then affect the actions, the behaviors that you do, which will then change your results. Okay? So, this is why I love this so much. Because it goes not just back to changing the behavior, because that's a temporary fix. It goes back to the root cause. And it's only by changing the root cause and by understanding what the root cause is that you're able to affect permanent change. And that's what we try to do with our clients. We try to educate them in why it is better, in most cases, to change their habits when it comes to pricing, and how we can potentially help them make more revenue, make more profit, and have a better business.
I have the feeling also that this change, or this capacity to accept this change, or to decide, as you said, is also linked to our capacity to accept. I mean, we have to recognize that we may be afraid. Mm-hmm. And the way we manage fear of losing something, fear of, and in our business of revenue management, we are talking money. And money is a big, big driver. Mm-hmm. For sure, we can have recognition, we can have power, we can have whatever we want. But money is extremely very important driver. How do you handle this, the fear, not implementing it, or say, okay, because at a particular moment of time, people may not act or may not decide because they are afraid about something. And it may come back to 30, 40, the way they have been educated as kids.
Yes. Yeah,
how do you handle the world, somebody, a stranger, something that you don't know at all? How do you handle a particular situation you are not comfortable with? How do you handle the fact that you speak in front of the other class, the roommates in your classroom? How do you take this into consideration, the approach around fear? Because for me, it's a big driver.
Yeah.
I would like to hear from you about this.
So, overcoming fear. First, so it's something that you mentioned. Money is another passion of mine, the topic of money. And I don't know what it's like in France, but in Ireland, it's a taboo subject. So we don't talk about it.
It's a bit the same in France. Yeah. Maybe it's the, either we said Judeo-Christian or maybe Catholic way, because usually Catholic people might be, we don't talk about this.
We don't talk about money.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a lady the other day, and she's on a mission. She's over in Florida, and she's on a mission to educate children in high school about money. And so she goes in, her whole business is about going into schools. At the moment, she's in Florida, and teaching children, teenagers, about money, about, say, budgeting, about abundance is another thing. Because the fear comes from believing that there is a lack of money. And some people agree or disagree with me, but I don't believe that there's a lack of money. There is an endless supply of money. We force a lack of money into our subconscious, passed down from one generation to another. If I think about, and no disrespect to my own parents, but what I was taught about money as a child, when we did talk about money, which was not very often, is that money is evil. Rich people are bad. Money doesn't grow on trees. Yeah, save every penny that you can. Hold on to it for a rainy day, etc., etc., etc. And what I came to the realization over the last number of years is that money is a magnifier, I think. And by that I mean, if you're a nice person without money, you're going to be a super nice person with money, because money gives you the ability to be nicer to more people, to spread the love with more people. And conversely, if you're without money, you're going to be double, treble, multiply that, you know, with money. I also believe that sort of at the core of it, nearly everybody is a nice person. The vast majority of people want everybody to do well and look out for other people. But so the first sort of step when it comes to the fear of that, because it's something that's very prevalent in a lot of businesses. We all spend a lot of time looking at our competition, going, oh, they're stealing business from me. They're going to take my business. There's not enough business for me. If they have this, they're going to get my customers, etc., etc. And they used to think I was a little bit crazy in sixth, but I was a firm believer there's enough business there for everybody. We get our percentage of our business by operating and concentrating on our business, by doing the best that we can for our customers, regardless of what everybody else is doing. I mean, do you need to be aware of what's going on in your industry? Of course you do, yeah? But if you spend all this time looking over your shoulder, you know, or looking around you at what everybody else is doing, your own house is going to fall. So I'm a big believer in concentrating on your business. I think it was Robert Kiyosaki that says about taking care of your business first. Yeah. So concentrate on what you have to do first before you worry about anybody else.
And he's also adding that before your business, you have to take care of yourself first.
Yes, yes.
You have to pay yourself first, the rest will follow.
Yeah. But that's that, because that sort of puts a pressure on you. Bob used to always say the same thing. You pay yourself first. Because once you pay yourself and you've got all these other people knocking on your door looking, well, where's my money? Yeah, that's going to put a pressure on you to succeed. Yeah, in order to push yourself to get past that and to get out there and to do it. So yeah, it's about changing that perception, and that's not easy. It's not easy, especially when it comes to money, because money is a very emotive subject. But there is, and for anybody that's listening, there is enough money out there for everybody. There's a law of compensation. And the law of compensation states that you get paid in direct proportion to the need for what you do, your ability to do it, and how easy you are to be replaced. So when you look at your business and you go, the need for what I do, is there a need for what I do? For most businesses, I would say yes. Yeah. Your ability to do it. Are you the best in your business? Are you the best in your sector at what you do? If you're not, that's where you need to concentrate on, is to be the best that you can possibly be. And how easy are you to be replaced? Well, if you're the best at what you do, you cannot be replaced easily. There's a big difference between somebody who works at, let's say, a fast food chain, maybe McDonald's or something like that. Is there a need for what they do? Yes, there is. Are they good at it? Yes, they can be good at it, but are they easily replaced? Absolutely. There's hundreds of other people who are willing and able to step in and to take that job if it comes up. And then if you look at like a brain surgeon or maybe what we do and we yield, you know, is there a need for what we do? Of course there is. Are we good at it? Yes, we're very good at it. Are we easily to be replaced? No, we're not. So the law of compensation is based on those three things. And I really like that one. Where were we?
We're talking about the fear.
The fear, yes, yeah. I think that can... helping just change somebody's perspective. Like you had it on the notebook last year. I can't remember his name.
Dwyer.
Wayne Dwyer.
Wayne Dwyer, yeah.
When you change how you look at things, what you look at changes. Is a brilliant thing. So we're so used to looking at things, and we look at our business, and because most car rental operators that I know, they work in a silo. They work in their own world, and they have very little touch with other people in the industry outside of their own business. So they don't know what's going on outside of it, and all they know is, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but all they know is their business. So it can really help to have somebody like us, for example, to look at their business and to see it with fresh eyes and to look at it in a slightly different way and help them to see that differently. Fear comes out of not knowing. Fear comes out of a lack of knowledge. Once you know what's happening, once you know what's going on, you are much more likely to embrace change and much more likely to embrace trying something differently. But to come back to where it was a few minutes ago, it's about baby steps, about trying little things over time in order to get rid of that fear to some extent.
And also accept that on this pathway, on this journey, you may lose some time. I was discussing with the general manager of Earth in Morocco, Guillaume Giry, and the guy said, whenever we try things, we have to accept that it will fail. Because if we go back to the image of kids, babies, when they start to stand up and they start walking, in fact, they are falling. And walking, even though now at 55, I mean, walking is an imbalance. Mm-hmm. So you have to create an imbalance to move. Mm-hmm. Then when you are falling, suddenly you take the other leg, and the other leg will prevent you to fall. Yeah. Otherwise, if we don't move this leg forward, we fall. But if we stand still, we don't move, mm-hmm. nothing will change. Exactly. And we are not going to move further. Yeah. So
it's an interesting way to look at walking. It's not walking, it's progressive falling.
Exactly.
Controlled falling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's funny because as a human being, we can just move forward with imbalance, so risk, mm-hmm. in fact, risk of falling. And whenever we looked at our business, we tried to keep it as it was mm-hmm. without testing new things.
Yeah. There's another one of my favorite quotes. Change is inevitable. Personal growth is a choice. So no matter what it is, and we all sort of look back at in rose-tinted glasses, and we look back at the way things were, and God, wouldn't it be great if things were the way they used to be, you know, when I was young, and et cetera, et cetera. But change is inevitable. I mean, what's going on now today is going to be different to what goes on tomorrow. It's going to be different from the day before. So you can either embrace it and grow and live, or you just stand still and you die. Because if you're not moving forwards, you're moving backwards. You said there a second ago about that walking has been sort of that sort of progressive falling. The fear of failure is one of the largest fears. There's a list in Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. There are, I think it is 13 major fears that we have, and fear of failure is one of them. Fear of ridicule is another. But when you think about it, everything, and what you say about kids is, I remember the first steps that my youngest daughter took was in the sitting room at home, And she took a step. I turned around to my wife and said, look, she's walking. And then next thing, bang, she fell and she cut her mouth open on the inside. And I was like, oh, my God. But, you know, if you don't fall, you don't learn. And the fear of failure, who said it? Fail fast and fail often. I think it was Steve Jobs, wasn't it?
I don't know who, but anyway, that's a Silicon Valley mantra, clearly. Yeah.
But you have to be willing to fail in order to learn, in order to grow. We haven't achieved anything in our life by getting it right all the time. You know, everything that we do, you know, we make mistakes. Everything. So you have to make mistakes in order to grow.
Mm. And I think in the car rental compared to the hotel industry, where you have been working, and I also been working in the hotel industry, the big difference also is that the inventory they buy, the asset of the company, is something that has between six to maybe 18 months, maybe 3 years length. When you buy and you build an hotel, it can be there for 30 years, even more. Mm-hmm. And you can sell it, you can change it, you can upgrade, you can do whatever you want. And this fear, like, I have to make the money back as quick as possible because I bought these cars, for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think it puts some pressure to our car rental operators. Not to take any risk in practice because they want to reapply what has been working well in the past. And for them, it's difficult to say, okay, let's give a try. Let's see how we can have, even though it's a minor part, let's say, let's play only on 10% of the inventory, maybe 20%. Let's see how it works. And we do two simultaneous tries. It's difficult for them.
Yeah. Change is difficult for everybody. But the idea, when we are so used to doing things in a certain way, I can't think of it now. We become slaves to habit. We become slaves to doing the way things have always been done. We work with some clients that have a hugely high percentage of their business, direct business. And then we have other clients who have the same percentage of their business as being indirect business. And we know that to make a resilient car rental operator, you need to have control over your destiny. And when we encourage our clients to do that, the initial reaction is always, yeah, but what about our partners? Yeah, they're going to give us X amount of bookings. And yes, the problem with that is if you never try something different, you're going to be stuck in this cycle of doing the same thing over and over and over again. All it takes is one attempt, one try to change your perspective on things and potentially create a stronger business for you that's more resilient and going to last longer and potentially be more profitable.
And in car rental, when you have these affiliations or these franchisee, we have one big client who said from the beginning that he wants to control his operating system.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's pushed by the brand to use the brand system, he said always no. Because I don't know what will be the future and I want to keep the control of my data, main data, I mean my operation, my staff, my clients, my cars, my price.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to face a lot of, he has to fight against those big brands to say, no, I'm not going to use your system.
Mm-hmm.
And those brands says, but you have to. But we also have some examples that sometime the brands come and say, okay, we are taking the sign off and you don't have any brand anymore. We don't renew your contract, your franchisee or your affiliation contract. And then if you don't have your own data, you don't have your own operating system, you lose everything from day one to another.
Yeah. It's phenomenal, isn't it? When you do that, you buy into a franchise, you adopt everything that they want you to adopt, and then literally at the flick of a switch, your entire business could be gone, unless you have the forward planning, like this client does, to maintain their own data separate to that. And probably fall back on whatever their own domestic brand was prior to the affiliate or the affiliation.
So it comes also, as you said earlier, also to develop the direct business.
Yeah.
And we know that as a marketing concept, to have 70, 80% of indirect business shares in your activity, it's a big risk.
Yeah.
Because if one operator, we know those big guys, we are in Berlin now for the ITB, so we know like rentalcarsbooking.com, Cartroller, all those big guys, if they want to switch, it's super easy for them.
Yeah.
So you are totally dependent, and the more relation we have with this indirect business, the more dependency we create, and then we are stuck.
Yeah. It's like it's like getting addicted to a drug. It can be like flicking a switch for a new operator. You sign up with a partner, and from day one to day two, you can see bookings coming through. And it's like what we used to call the low-hanging fruit. It's the easy things to do.
Mm-hmm.
The more difficult thing is to have a strategic plan that you're working towards, that may not bear fruit this year, may not bear fruit next year, yeah? But 3 years, 4 years down the line, you would be able to reap the rewards from it. It's a long-term plan.
Yeah, and developing direct business requires some investment. And I agree with you, developing your own website, your own search engine optimization, the keyword, blah, blah, takes a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
So we will not get result on the first year.
Yeah.
Clearly not. And that's interesting because you were talking about the brain earlier. Samakaraki said last time that in fact, the brain more or less weighs 5% of the total body, but it consumes 20% of the energy.
Yeah, yeah.
So in fact, if the brain does not set some reflex and automatisms, it will require much more energy to work. That's the reason why Daniel Kahneman said that we said system slow, system fast, or system one or system two.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever, in fact, it's just we just create habits and reflex, physically speaking, just to consume less energy.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we will require much more.
But imagine if you had to think every day that I need to breathe. I need to breathe. Oh, I need to pump the blood. Oh, I need to do this. I need to do whatever my kidneys do, and I need to operate that mentally. I need to do that. That's when I talk about a software, like a computer program that controls the body. Yeah. And that's what those pre-wired, as you said. But that was in a very interesting book, because I Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. I read that after you recommended it. It was very, very good. But it's essentially what he's talking about is system two was the conscious mind and system one was the subconscious mind, I think it was. That the all the programming, all the automation, let's say, is within the subconscious mind or the system one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now you have, you said that you have some this kind of approach of repetition, and also do you have other techniques or other ways in order to accompany this change without any fear or reducing the fear of your client?
So when I talk to people about goals, and goals are an amazing thing. Each of us have different types of goals, and success for me is different to what success means to you, etc. There is really that constant space repetition is really the only way that is proven that I can teach somebody to change their programming. There's one bit that I didn't mention earlier on. When I talk about goals with people, we have what I call type A, type B, and type C goals. A type A goal is something that you're going to aim at that you know you can do. Perhaps you've done it already. Okay, I don't encourage those sort of goals because there's no growth in it. You're not trying to, the idea behind goals is to draw something out from within you that maybe you didn't even know was there. It's to grow, it's to learn something new. A type B goal is something that you think you're able to do. So you go logically in the conscious mind, you go, right, if step A, step B, step C, step D, if I do that and that and that and that, then I can, maybe I can reach my goal. The problem with logic is there's no emotion involved in it. And if something happens, like between step A and step B, there's a little speed bump or something like that, chances are you go, oh, well, I'm not going to continue because it's too hard. I'm not going to do it. So then we go on and we talk about type C goals. And type C goals are wants, or what I call desires. Napoleon Hill in Think and Grow Rich talks all the time about having a burning desire. You know, and that's the only way I can really describe it to somebody. I have a burning desire. I can feel it here in my chest that I want to accomplish something. And that's what I'm working towards. So when you have that burning desire within you, that feeling within you that you're working towards something, nothing is going to stop you from doing it. So that emotion that you have, emotion lives in the subconscious mind, is a big part in creating these new paradigms. And create and fooling your subconscious mind into believing that it has already achieved. So the strongest emotions that you can experience are gratitude, love, and happiness. So when I write my goal, which I do every morning, I write down that I am so happy and grateful now that I have blah, 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 whatever the goal is that you're working towards. So you're infusing your goal with emotion. So you're infusing your goal with gratitude that you've already achieved it, with happiness that you've already achieved it. So you're working from the end. I can't think of the name. I'll remember it. Says that you're always working from the end. You're working from the belief that you have achieved backwards. Not here looking forward at what I want to achieve. I'm talking to myself, and I'm my subconscious mind. I am telling my subconscious mind that I am so happy and grateful now that I have it. I can feel it. I can touch it. And this is where visualization is a huge part of achieving goals. And I believe if you're able to experience it in some way. So let's say, for example, you want to have a new Bentley, for example, all right?
So you mean new because I have one already?
Yes, two.
Good so, to know, I didn't know.
So how do you get the, how do you know what it feels like to sit in a Bentley? You go and you sit in a Bentley. Yeah. How do you know what it feels like to have hundreds of euros or dollars in your hands? Well, somehow you can go on to AliExpress and you can get fake money and you can feel it and you can count it out and you go, this is me counting hundreds and hundreds of euros, you know, and you're fooling your subconscious mind, doesn't know that it's not real. You're just getting in the emotion of doing whatever it is that you want. So visualization, I have my what's it called? My visualization chart for 2024, it sits right beside me on my desk at home, and I look at it every day. And by looking at it every day, again, I'm doing that constant space repetition. So I'm writing my goal out in the morning time. I'm looking at what my goal is. Each time I look at it and write it, I can feel it. I get emotionally connected to it, which means for me, I know that nothing is going to come between me and what it is that I want to achieve. And that's... I know that can sound a little bit strong or a little bit strange for people, but that is the mindset that you need to be. If you are, let's say, they have a term called a wantrepreneur and an entrepreneur. So a wantrepreneur is somebody who goes, oh, geez, you know, it might be nice to be an entrepreneur. Maybe I might like to do it. And then you've got, like, so yourself, who's an entrepreneur who's gone out and done it, yeah? I'm reading a book at the moment called Million Dollar Weekend, and that's the first step in it is don't think about it, just do it, yeah? action is the name of it. Once you make a decision, then you take steps towards it. You What did he say? Making the first bit of money is maybe selling something to somebody for a dollar. Yeah, it could be selling it to your wife for a dollar. Here's something I made, honey. Okay, here's a dollar. That's it. I can make money by doing this. And that, he doesn't go into the depths of mindset, etc. But what he's saying is exactly that in his way of thinking about it. We have a term that we call an unconscious competent. And that is somebody who is successful. They think in a certain way. They think, if I think this way, then everybody should think this way. So if I'm successful, everybody should be successful. Whatever success means to them. And that is quite often why you will see, let's say a father creates a company, makes it a successful company, but he can't pass on to the children how he thought about the business so that they can continue to drive it on and be more successful. That person is an unconscious competent. They're successful, they don't know why they're successful. And if we go back to where we were at the beginning of the conversation, it's about knowledge, about understanding, if you want to affect permanent change. And the same thing, if someday I have a business and I'm passing it on to my girls, I already draw the stick diagram for them. I was on the beach in Gran Canaria and I drew it out on the beach for them to explain, try to explain it to them, that they begin to understand from an early age the difference between the conscious and subconscious and how it interacts with what they do, why they do what they do, and if they're not getting the results that they want, how to change. Probably studied physics in school when you were
a long time ago, yeah.
To every action, there's an equal but opposite reaction. So that's the basis behind your action, your behavior causes you to do something. That by doing something, you get a reaction back, and that reaction is your result. So if you have a negative result that you're getting, then you got to change the action, okay? But if the action is programmed into your mind, then you need to change the programming in order to do that. So your thoughts influence your emotions or your beliefs. Your beliefs determine your behaviors, and your behaviors determine your results. It's a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There is for the one who didn't read the Robert Kiyosaki, Poor Dad, Rich Dad.
Yeah.
The beginning of the book is exactly on the way the with this library and the way the guy, I think, is the father of one of the son, who is educating the kids,
yeah,
with this book, this used book, and not book but like magazines and papers,
yes,
newspaper,
yeah.
And that's amazing. I will not disclose and spoil the guy who wants to read it, but it's just amazing. And when you were talking about this, the fact that the parents sometimes they want to give the company that they have built, and there is a lack of understanding what, mm-hmm, was the energy behind. I recently see a Netflix documentary about Liliane Bettencourt. She's the wealthiest woman on earth. She's, mm-hmm, the largest owner of L'Oréal.
Mm-hmm.
And this company is about now, I would say, 70, 80 years old. Since day one, they never put the children into the company.
Mm.
They always ask somebody from the outside, mm, to run the company.
Mm.
Because maybe they knew that in a moment or not, eventually the kids will not develop the company, but will manage it or run it.
Yeah.
And we know that sometimes there is a kind of story. You said the first generation build the company, the second they run it, and the third they ruin it.
Yes.
They ruins it. So I don't know if it was intentional, but they never put their kids running any business at L'Oréal whatsoever. That's amazing. And since 80 years, they are still one of the largest companies, at least the number one in cosmetics, around the world.
It's crazy.
Well, like with LVMH, Mr. Arnault, Louis Vuitton, Wet & See. He, since day one, he has decided to put all these kids, I think he has four or five kids, into the business. But interesting enough, Every week they have a meeting with the father.
Mm.
And the guy for the last 10 or 20 years, I don't know, is educating them.
Mm.
So every week they have to review business decision, how to tackle the topic, how to develop a business, whatever. And those guys, it took, I don't know, maybe, I don't know when he started. The kids are maybe around 30s, 40s, I have no clue. They have been educated for the last 20 years
yeah.
to be ready. Because the guy maybe 70, I don't know how old is he, but he will not length for forever. So yes, preparation, I mean, organizing, it takes a lot of time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's one of those topics that's very close to my heart because, as I said, I've got two kids. And I want them to be choose what they want to do. I don't want to really ever push anything on them. However, to give them as much background to everything, different points of view, so that they're then able to make. And when I was working in Sixt, we had an outside company called Frontline Performance Group, FPG. And they came in with a sales wheel. And this was how the rental agents, and we taught the rental agents how to sell our protections, et cetera, how to increase our incremental sales. And one phrase always stuck with me. And it's about offering every product to every customer every time and allowing the customer to make an informed buying decision. And it's the same thing when I think about my kids. I want them to know as much as possible. I'm a firm believer that the way education and the way what we were taught or what I was taught as a child, and possibly you were the same thing of, you know, get a good education, get a job, stay in the job for 40 years, retire, etc. You know, you'll be looked after. Those days are long gone. Yeah. The in the last 20 to 30 years, I know in my own career, if I look at my father was a school teacher. He had that job from the day he left school until the day he retired. That was the job. Whereas myself in my career, I've had a number of different careers, let's say, and definitely a good few number of different jobs. And for my kids, it's going to be the same thing, I think, but to really focus on building a business. Because when it's not that when you are your own boss, you've got no worries. Of course, you've got lots of worries when you're your own boss. However, if you want to increase the amount of money that you're making, and I'm not one of these who believes that money is bad. I think money is good because if I want to help people, I can help an awful lot more people, as I said, when I've got more money. I can sit on the sideline with no money and commiserate with them that we're all poor, but that doesn't help anybody. So for the future, for my kids and for anybody really, I'm a big believer in starting a business and trying to figure out, even just think about it, you know. It's so easy these days to start a business online. I've done 4 or 5 of them at this stage, yeah, and they've all been crap. But I've learned an awful lot along the way. And that's absolutely fine with me. I'm going for a 20, 30, 40. I'm in my 40s now. I've got maybe another. I said to my wife the other day, I said, I'm going to live to 100. And then when I'm just gone 100, then I can go. But that's my plan. Is I have another 50 years ahead of me, 60 years ahead of me. I don't ever intend retiring in the traditional sense of going and living on an island and drinking Mai Tais and doing nothing. I would be bored. So, you know, to be able to do the freedom that comes with being a business owner, let's say, having multiple businesses even, and something that generates income for you that is not tied to you being within the business is, I suppose, for most people, the ultimate goal. But yeah, so no gold watch or whatever at the end of 40 years anymore. Those days are gone.
We are close to the end now. If you have the chance to meet Adrian at the end of the teenage, like 20, 18, yeah. 19, 20s, what kind of advice would you give to him?
So, like a lot of people, I think when I finished college, I thought that was it. Education is done. I've learned my profession. Yeah, and that's it. I don't need to worry about education anymore. And if I was to go back to me at 22, I would give myself a slap across the back of the head and go, keep reading books. Just keep learning. The amount of knowledge, my kids laugh at me because a new book comes every other day in the post. need more time to read them. But it's about constantly developing yourself. Working in the hotel industry and then in car hire for, especially with Enterprise, time outside of the work was a luxury. There wasn't a lot of it. And so what there was spent with partying and having fun. If I could flip things around and say, right, work hard between 20 and 30, and then you can have 70 years of partying and having fun if you want. Yeah. I think that would be my advice to myself. Have you got a time machine, Manuel? Have you?
Thank you. Would you share with our audience any... you shared a lot of references, a lot of books already, a lot of authors. Do you have anything particular? Or it can also be a kind of documentary, whatever, that was really like, if you have one thing to keep in mind, mm-hmm. of tomorrow, if we go on the whatever, don't talk about Amazon, it's not my favorite system, even though I'm super impressed by what Jeff Bezos has built, but still... would you have any big recommendation or suggestion to make for our audience to start this mindset change, you know, this transformation?
An oldie but a goodie. But one that an awful lot of people do recommend is Napoleon Hill. Think and Grow Rich. Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Napoleon Hill is a little bit controversial. However, the information that is within that book, it's over 100 years old now. It's about 100 and something years old. It takes a little bit of reading because the language that's in it is a little bit old-fashioned, etc. I needed a dictionary to figure out what some of the words were. But the concepts behind it are phenomenal. There's 12 steps. To success, or 12 steps to financial independence, and I think that is a fantastic one. Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad Poor Dad, or the next one after that, which is the Cash Flow Quadrant.
Quadrant.
Yeah. Okay. So do you know the way he talks about being an employee, being self-employed, to being a business owner, to being an investor, and that. I was talking to somebody the other day, and the biggest takeaway that I got from Robert Kiyosaki was the definition of an asset. So an asset is something that puts money into your bank account. Whereas when we were kids, you know, we were taught that your house is your biggest asset and your car is your second biggest asset. Your house costs you a bloody fortune. You're going to pay probably 1.5 to 2 times what your house is actually worth by the time you're 35 or 40 years or over from your mortgage. It's not an asset, it's a liability. Your car costs you so much money and they depreciate like a rock. Yeah. So when you think about the utilization on your car, your own personal car probably at best has got probably about a 20% utilization over the course of a week. You
at best, I agree with
you. Best, yeah.
Actually, you buy a car to sit in the parking.
Yes.
The parking
to look at it and go, oh, I've got a lovely car. You know, I love cars. But anyway, so those, your two biggest assets are in reality your two biggest liabilities. And again, to go back to talking to myself as a younger person, forget about the nice car when you're in your 20s. Get a banger. Get something that you can afford. Yeah, and the nice car will come over time if you apply the rest of the principles in order to grow revenue for yourself. And the last one is Psycho-Cybernetics, by Dr. Maxwell Maltz. And that is the one that explains in more detail than I did here today about how your subconscious mind operates like a cybernetic mechanism. And the best way I can explain a cybernetic mechanism, I flew here today on a plane. Autopilot is a cybernetic mechanism. The pilot will put in his destination, put in where he wants to go, and the plane flies itself, pretty much. The pilots are obviously, they're there because they know what to do when things go wrong. But the plane will fly on autopilot pretty much itself. If there's a big bit of turbulence, or if there's, you know, wind that can get blown off course, the cybernetic mechanism brings it back on course again. And so the cybernetic mechanisms are to do with mechanics. Psycho-cybernetics is how that applies in your mind. Yeah, and that's the paradigm. And that's what needs to be changed in order to change lasting results. Last one. Change Your Paradigm, Change Your Life by Bob Proctor. He's passed away, as I said, about 2 years ago now. The man dedicated 60 years of his life to researching this information and to sharing it with as many people as he possibly could. And it's a very good read. He, like me, he keeps it simple.
Okay, so we'll put all these book references on the notes of this episode. Thank you very much, Adrien, for this time shared. It was extremely interesting to have to know you better first, but also to explore more this mindset and how we can continue to grow and explore and learn and become a better person, I would say. So thank you for your time.
A pleasure. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It's great. It's a topic that I can talk about till the cows come home. But thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
You reached the end of the Revenue Machine podcast. I hope you enjoyed this moment of sharing ideas and tips. Give us a 5-star if you liked it. That's the only way to be seen in the magma of podcast. You can also forward this podcast to 2 other people you love. Wheel Team is available to help car rental operators who are frustrated by the data they have and the data they would like to have, but also the one who wants to be guided along their revenue transformation process. Contact us. Bye-bye.